I'm talking about the situation in the U.S., and it's interesting that it's, I think, very appropriate, interestingly, that I came last, because I think in the U.S. sometimes we think, you know, we've been at this, we're ahead of the game, and the truth is almost all the statistics I look at are virtually identical, and in some cases I think we're way behind, particularly on the integration of, the issue of integration of services in our healthcare system. Let me go through a little bit of just the prevalence stuff, because again, I think folks don't always know how bad it is here. And it's what we know is it's about 1 in 6 and 1 in 33 men on average will be victims of rape or attempted rape. It still remains one of, if not the most underreported crime. And again, that prevalence should always be sort of your baseline, the easy thing, you know, how often does it happen? Who does it happen to? Where does it happen? I don't think anybody who does this still feels like they have really good numbers, particularly when we talk about family violence, particularly when it's within the context of marriage or an ongoing relationship. So I think there's still a lot of just very baseline data that we need. We still are looking at about 500 women a day in this country who are raped. Most of the victims are young and usually female. Again, I think some researchers have started to question the rates of sexual violence, particularly against boys and men, that maybe those are also less reported. And again, I think there's a sense that the clergy abuse scandal here in the U.S. made us more able to talk about abuse against boys and men. But again, we have the data, but I wouldn't consider it the law right now. And again, it's adolescents as well. And again, I think there is this thing about sort of that fuzzy area about what's rape, what's coercion, what's force. And I think we need to struggle with that. So again, and I'll just kind of run through some of this. 1 in 4 high school girls have been a victim of physical abuse, sexual abuse, or date rape. A lot of the data in the U.S. doesn't distinguish that necessarily. I know researchers struggle with that because they want to parse that out. I think we as advocates actually like it together because it's much more real to women's lives. They don't necessarily separate their childhood victimization versus their physical victimization versus their sexual victimization. It often very much goes together in their real lived lives. Young people, again, 16 to 24, have some of the highest rates. But again, we think it actually probably is younger. And again, going to the next stat, about half of female victims and nearly 3/4 of the male victims were raped before their 18th birthday. And a lot of the data we have on childhood sexual abuse is obviously retrospective, right? So it's people being asked as adults about what happened to them as kids. So we think that the rates, I mean, I think we're quite confident that the rates, the majority of victims of sexual violence in the U.S. are children, or certainly young adults. And I think the question is, it's very hard, obviously, to get that data while they're still children. Again, the trends, I think we believe sexual violence is down over the last 15 years. And we have data that if you look at sort of using the same crime victimization survey, and then we also have a violence against women survey, the next iteration of which is about to go into the field, we do feel like we see declines. The one area where we're not seeing declines as much is on college campuses. And again, I think there is some question about whether that's really a reporting issue. We're also seeing, and this is the part that always breaks my heart, you know, you live in this world and yet things still shock your conscience. And it's about young, very young children. I just was at an event at the Violence Against Women office, and this woman was talking about trying to provide, what do you do with a 2-year-old? And they don't have services, and none of, for instance, the Violence Against Women Act, which I'll get into later, most of our services for sexual assault and domestic violence aren't for children. They're for adults. And so we've tried to change that legally, but there are still shockingly few services available for victims of sexual violence, and particularly for children. And we know, obviously, that early victimization puts you at much greater risk for later victimization and perpetration. So this is an area where we really feel like so much more needs to be done and understood. And again, the other thing that I think is always really important when we think about our services and interventions, and this was brought up by previous speakers as well, most victims of sexual assault know they're a perpetrator. And what are the consequences when that perpetrator is a family member, is a close friend, is a clergy? It's going to change how our legal system works. It's going to change how we provide services. It's going to really change when and how reporting is done and who's reported to. It's often not going to be law enforcement, and yet that's where our data collection systems are typically, is within the law enforcement realm. So again, I think these are always questions to keep in mind. I also wanted to really focus, and I appreciated that the session we followed was one on healthcare in Indian country. highest rates, overwhelmingly in the U.S., are really of Native women, most often by non-Native men. And I think that's another part of it that is often lost. And again, I really appreciated what you were saying about that it's accountability and perpetration is critical, because one of the real pieces of one of the reasons people think rates are so high in Indian country is the complicated laws about tribal justice systems are not necessarily allowed to prosecute non-members of the tribe. And so when the overwhelming majority of those perpetrating violence against Native women are non-Native men, the most they will ever be punished is up to a year. Right. So, and again, what we keep hearing from Indian women is so often they're the neighbor. I mean, they're seeing their perpetrator every day. I have a good friend who literally is across the street from the man who raped her daughter. And what are the consequences of seeing every day your perpetrator or your child's perpetrator? And so that we need, often the experiences of Native women are very invisible in the U.S. And so I think there's been a lot of work recently. Amnesty International gets a lot of credit, but I think they will be the first to tell you, you know, they're merely trying to use the spotlight that they have to bring attention to the work that Native women advocates have been doing for decades right now on the rates of violence. So I think the other thing that was really brought forth in the recent Amnesty report is that this issue about it's sexual violence, but it's also a lot more violence. It's a lot, in addition, there's intention to do even much greater harm to women, it seems. And again, no one ever likes to sort of create degrees around sexual violence. I think we all get very nervous about that. But there does tend to be a lot more other, more severe physical injuries when you look at violence against Native women. And I'm going to move on. So the consequences, and I want to get into this physical health piece, because again, I think there's a lot of myths out there about what a sexual violence victim looks like, what a rape victim looks like, and that we often expect these very serious physical injuries. And the fact is most victims don't experience probably about a third require treatment, medicine or treatment for the physical injuries. That's not the majority. And again, I think go back to who we're talking about, which is that they're often children, right? And we're often looking at coercion and force that is not necessarily because someone jumped you out of the bushes and beat you, right? And we need to understand that again when we're talking about services, when we're talking about how we're identifying victims and how we prosecute these cases, because we're not doing a good job at that, which I'll get to in just a moment. The other thing, if we do have a minute, the longer-term physical injuries, right, we often look at sort of what are the physical injuries that happen at the time of the incident. And when we look at the health consequences of sexual violence, that's the tiny, tiny piece, right? That's not the cost to the healthcare system. That's not the serious, it's not that we don't want to pay attention to what happens right at that time. In the healthcare setting, we need to work on that. But the health consequences of sexual violence are much bigger, much longer, and not going to necessarily be at that point. And I think the study that I love the most, and I just now talk about it in every opportunity I can, is the ACE study, which is the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And this was a joint research project by Dr. Vince Folletti, who's with Kaiser, actually out in San Diego, and Dr. Robert Anda, who's with the CDC. And they found, I think the best part from an advocate's perspective is that Dr. Folletti is an obesity researcher. You know, he's not some feminist activist. You know, sure that there's sexual violence everywhere, right? You know, he's a guy who developed this system for helping people lose a lot of weight. And the thing that he found was he was having great success, but the people who were losing the weight the most, the people who were most successful in the program, were the ones dropping out. And that just goes counter to everything we think, right? You'd think the people who were losing, you know, dropping hundreds of pounds would be the ones who were most invested in the program, the most likely to stick it through. And so he was trying to understand why people, particularly women, you know, why were they dropping out of this study? And he saw, you know, kind of in the literature somewhere that there was this relationship between sexual violence and weight and obesity in women. And so he said, okay, well, I guess I should, you know, maybe start asking about that. And he tells this story, and you know, he's wonderful, and he's an obesity researcher, and I walk in, and he, you know, he's very self-deprecating and willing to say, you know, I didn't quite ask it right the first time, and I was clearly a little awkward, and so I went in, and I'm an obesity researcher, and right, what do? I always ask people, how much did you weigh when? How much did you weigh when? So he asks this woman, how much did you weigh at first sexual debut, right, is often how it's asked. And she said 40 pounds. And he caught himself, right? And he was starting to correct himself. He meant to ask how old she was, right? That's what he meant to ask. But silly him, you know, he says, oh, I always ask how much you weigh. And then that's when it hit, right? That's when he says that was the moment. And she starts, you know, 40 pounds. I was 8 years old. It was my dad. And he goes, holy cow, kind of what have I found? And then he started asking the question among all of his folks that he was working with. And then he started seeing these incredibly high rates. And these are Kaiser Permanente HMO enrollees in San Diego County, right? So this is a very middle class, very racially, ethnically, socially, economic diverse sample. And he's finding these, you know, 25 and 30% rates of childhood sexual abuse. And he's going, this can't be right. And so he started to get other people to ask the question. Then kind of went and got Bob Anda from the CDC. Okay, I'm going to go get hardcore epidemiologist researcher from the CDC. No one can question that, you know, our methodology or anything. And again, and what they're finding is this enormous rates. And then what they did is as often is the case, they expanded it to looking at adverse childhood experiences. And so they've got just this dream, in many ways, data set of tens of thousands, I think over hundreds of thousands now, of folks who have been interviewed about a list of things that bad things that happened when they were kids. So whether it's sexual violence, physical violence, a parent with a serious substance abuse problem, incarceration, and they have this series of questions and show, I mean, everything from unplanned pregnancy, but they've even now got the data tied to how many prescriptions Medicare pays for you relative to your ACEs, right? So relative to how many bad things happened when you were 7, we can now document that the more things that happened, adverse childhood experiences you had, the more you're costing Medicare in your 70s. You're taking more medicines, whether it's for heart disease, whether it's for the... And again, then that's the part, the links that they're trying to figure out. And I think that's where in terms of what are the health consequences, that's the relationship we haven't figured out, which is that victims of sexual violence are less healthy in a lot of ways. And what's the relationship? Is it you're more likely to have substance abuse and mental health issues? Those lead to X, X leads to Y, Y leads to heart disease. We haven't figured that piece out yet, but take advantage of my extra time to talk a little about that. And again, I think we talked about, I don't think it's going to come as news, that it's far more about the mental health and substance abuse issues that are often related to histories of sexual violence and trauma. And again, we use dating violence, which often merges the physical and sexual, but often when we're talking about teens and youth, we're almost always talking about a sexual piece as well. So again, tobacco, cocaine, again, unplanned pregnancy, 50% of youth reported dating violence or rape, reported suicide attempts, right? So when we're looking at suicidality, we're very often looking at rape and trauma. Girls who are raped are more likely to suffer, obviously, from psychiatric disorders, and again, more drug and alcohol abuse. And I think there's a pretty good documented data on those consequences, and I think not necessarily the hows and whys just yet. I think reproductive health is the area where people are really focusing their attention. But again, I think it's really important. There's violence that happens, and I think this that is reproductive health consequences of the immediate act of rape or the trauma of rape. But again, I think the far bigger impact is going to be on other issues. For instance, late entry into prenatal care. Women will often stop seeing their OBGYN, okay? So what are the consequences of that? What's the first, she gets pregnant. It's often when she, that may be the first time a victim of sexual trauma may go see a doctor again. And what does that mean when she's seeing a health provider for the first time because she's pregnant and has not had health care in many cases for years? So late entry into prenatal care, she's not getting her cancer screenings regularly, she's not getting her pap tests, and certainly the relationship between engaging in more risky sexual behavior. And again, we really struggle as advocates because on the one hand, you know, from our perspective, you know, no woman is ever at all responsible for her rape, right? It is the perpetrator who is the one to be held accountable for the sexual violence. What the data also tell us, however, is that if you have been a victim of violence as a child, you are far more likely to be a victim of violence as an adolescent. If you've had both of those, you're far more likely to be a victim of violence in adulthood. And so what we need to understand that better, and that's not necessarily blaming the victim, when we try to do that research and understand that relationship as well. Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry, can you go back one more? I'm sorry. The one thing I did also really want to draw attention to is, you know, around teen pregnancy, you're looking at a lot of, particularly young girls. So the 13s and 14-year-olds, you're looking at a lot of histories of sexual abuse and trauma that they are not going to label as rape, right? So particularly among adolescents, particularly in marriage, particularly or among long-term relationships, if you ask somebody, have you been raped, they will say no. If you ask someone, are you a victim of sexual abuse, they will say no. If you ask them, has somebody in your relationship ever made you do something sexually that you didn't want to do or that made you feel humiliated or really embarrassed? And embarrassed, again, is kind of it can be a tricky word as well. Then you're going to get much higher reporting numbers. So I think that's always something to really keep in mind. And again, you know, talking about adolescents, they're trickier in terms of who they're going to talk to, what they're going to tell them, what is about their presentation about the incident or ongoing incidents, right? What if she's 13 and he's 24? She doesn't think it's a sexually abusive or coercive relationship. In many cases, she's not going to define it as that. What happens when he's her landlord, her mom's landlord, right? You know, she doesn't necessarily think she's being abused or coerced, and she's not going to seek services. She's not going to report it. So we need to always be keeping those things in mind. And the rapid repeat pregnancy issue as well. Okay, go ahead. And again, I think I talked a little bit about this throughout. I always like to take advantage of when I have researchers and good thinkers around public health in the room to get some of my questions out there myself as an advocate, which is that the relationship between sexual violence and trauma and the criminal justice system, the foster care system, welfare, and TANF. Again, we know relationships between experiences of violence put women much more likely to be on TANF, much more likely to be low income, seem to be more relationship with the child welfare and foster care system. But again, that's probably around substance abuse. And again, it's messy, right? I keep getting all these different studies. I keep having people who work with substance abusing moms say, you know, I'm dealing with sexual violence. I'm a sexual violence provider, right? I mean, this is the first time her sexual violence is being dealt with, which is through her substance abuse. And now I'm trying to manage how she parents with her kid and that she may not be able to parent well right now. But really what I'm dealing with is sexual trauma, particularly in childhood and adolescence. So how do we do that? How do we tease out multiple victimizations? It's often not one incident in the dark of night by a stranger through the bedroom window. That does happen. It is by no means to minimize the impact of that experience on a woman. But again, the vast majority of rapes and sexual violence are not the stranger through the window in the middle of the night, a one-time thing. I talked about this relationship with later victimization and the age and gender differences as well. You know, we see men, and for probably some pretty understandable reasons, far higher rates of victimization in childhood, right? Not as much in adulthood, but then clearly a relationship between victimization in childhood and perpetration in adulthood. And often that line, and again, we struggle with this in terms of advocates, is, you know, when does he go from being a victim to a perpetrator? Is there a magic age? he's a child until he's 12, and then from 13 on, he gets pretty scary, and we're going to, you know, so we have this child welfare prevention, early intervention system for him then, and then from 13 on, we've got the juvenile justice system for him, where he's getting no therapeutic services whatsoever, no recognition that he's truly a victim, and we, at this point, our systems are very poor at dealing with that, and I think a lot of that sort of stems from our not understanding the issue well. So what are the laws? It's illegal everywhere, but it doesn't mean much. And I shouldn't say it doesn't mean much. It's important. You need to have it to be against the law, okay? That matters. That doesn't solve the problem in and of itself. I don't want to be so flip. Looking at the National Violence Against Women survey, if you ask women, and again, this is adult women, right, who were raped since they were 18, so that's already a minority of those who have been victims. Only 7.8% ever said the rapist is criminally prosecuted, 3.3% said the rapist is convicted, and a mere 2.2% said the rapist was ever incarcerated. Okay? Now, these are among women who report rapes on a phone survey, right? So that's, again, already folks who are willing to do that. Now, that does not necessarily include women who reported their rape to the police. So that's important, obviously. It's going to be hard to engage the criminal justice system if you never report the assault to law enforcement. But even among, again, and that's the next one, even among women who report to police, only about 37% of those cases are prosecuted. Of those, only 40% garner convictions. And of those, even a conviction, only 3/4 ever serve time. So the criminal justice system is not addressing this issue adequately. And again, it doesn't mean you don't address the criminal justice system. It doesn't mean you don't try to engage the system to do a better job. But it means it's not solving the problem. And clearly, as we all know, we're at a public health conference, you know, engaging the problem, we're way down the road at the point at which we're talking about the criminal justice system. right? And so we're really about how do we move it back upstream? How do we sort of engage the individual, the community, the family, et cetera? So what's going on? So there are federal laws around sexual violence in the United States. Interestingly enough, the federal government does not fund rape crisis centers. We do not fund services for victims of rape. We do fund the rape prevention and education program that is only about funded at about half of authorization levels. And that was first passed, Violence Against Women Act was first passed in 94. RPE continues, was included at the, in the most recent reauthorization, but again, only funded about $45 million this year. And the nice thing, though, is that we did change in the Violence Against Women Act this time around a lot of the definitions so that services can go to youth victims as well. The new VAWA also created, for the first time, a sexual assault services program, which is funded at $50 million. The current appropriations bills include about $10 million. We don't know if there is going to be a congressional budget this year. There should have been done September 30th, and no one at this point I know of sees an endgame to how the U.S. government is going to fund itself, and so we may be back into a continuing resolution, so there would be no new funding for these programs for the next year. The other thing that I think a lot of folks have started to recognize is the need that culture really matters. Culturally and linguistically specific services really matter. I think they matter for everybody. I think particularly in the context of sexual assault and violence, they matter even more, right? And so women are, you know, at the point at which we're still waiting for women, you know, on the one hand, we have systems that wait for women to come to us, which is kind of problem one. Some women are coming to you, but a lot aren't. So you got to have your services out where women are. They're not focused on young women, which is still who the majority of your victims are, so we got to get to where young women are. And the cultural competence, and again, it may very well be the Latin American Youth Center, maybe the far better service providers for sexual assault victims in my community than the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. And not that they're not phenomenal women doing great work, you know, but, you know, you got to have a different system of where people are and who they are and in services that are way that are going to be meaningful to them. So what do we need to do? And where is there some real promising programs on this sort of, and some of this is, I think, good research, and probably there'll be one piece of it that's a little bit of my soapbox, which is that we need to focus on prevention, right? We need to move upstream. The systems, the post-rape, post-sexual assault systems are themselves inadequate, and I think all of us agree that we'd far rather stop the initial assault or stop the re-victimization than just wait and lock people up at the end of the day. In a way that we don't even do that well. I think the other argument that we tend to make a lot is that so much of our response to, particularly around child sexual abuse, is this is good touch, bad touch. And again, there are some very good things about that, but it still sort of says that a child is the one responsible for recognizing sexual violence, for distinguishing what is appropriate, and then for telling somebody about it. And that's not, from our perspective, and you'll notice my soapbox, that's not okay, right? That's not how we're going to fix the problem, and that's not, the child is not the one that's responsible. And how many children, no matter what has happened to them, want to put daddy in jail, right? And they don't that often, okay? And they don't want to talk about their coaches necessarily, and they don't want to talk about their uncle, and they don't want to talk about their stepdad, and sometimes their stepmom, and they're not the ones whose job it is to solve this problem. Right, and it's not necessarily the victim's job to solve this problem. It's our job, and I think particularly our job in this room as public health practitioners, it's our job to go stop this before it happens and to set up the systems in place that prevent the violence or intervene, identify it and intervene much earlier to prevent future victimization. So what are some of the ways to do that? Engagement. And it's not just that every, again, sometimes people say, oh, the men are the perpetrators, and that's why we've got to deal with men. Yes. The overwhelming majority of perpetrators of sexual violence are men, and probably, and we don't know this for sure, but probably the overwhelming of them were victims of childhood sexual abuse or adolescent sexual violence as well, or some form of physical abuse, right? So we need to both sort of recognize that by helping those who have been victimized early, we're sort of helping prevent violence. We also got to realize there's a lot of men out there who feel as passionately as every woman in this room does that sexual violence is wrong and want to be a part of the solution. And we've not done in my opinion, at least, a real good job yet of engaging men in this work. And they want to be a part of this work, and some can be our absolute best allies in this work, and some of them are doing this work. And so we need to sort of recognize them, engage them, realize men are role models, are leaders, have access to resources, and sort of quit kind of separating them out as, you know, this is our little woman's issue over here, and the men, if they're involved, it's because they're the perpetrators. And I sort of feel responsible for my own movement a little bit, because I think we've probably been the worst at that. So we need to change that. What else do we know? Early intervention and positive youth development. Again, it's like, you know, you find kids that are struggling. You got to start asking about this. You got to start assessing for it, and you got to start getting them the services that they need in ways, again, that are culturally competent, that understand trauma, and that understand sexual abuse as well. And we do need trained and accessible mental health services, and I don't think that's going to be news to anybody. Again, particularly for children and adolescents who have been victimized. So we've got to start doing the big social norm change piece early on. This violence is never okay. We've got to do the helping youth who are at greater risk or may have been victimized. And then those who have been victimized, we've got to get them good services as early as possible. Okay, and some of the sort of promising programs that are out there, and I just wanted to list this as some resources for you. There's some good dating violence prevention programs out there. And again, dating violence tends to be sort of the overlap among adolescents around physical and sexual abuse. So Choose Respect is a good one. Safe Dates is out of SAMHSA. And I know that there's actually been presentations at this conference before and in the APHA Journal about, you know, measuring and evaluating the success of the program. I think Men Can Stop Rape is doing really dynamic work around specifically the male involvement, male engagement. They have what they call their Men of Strength campaign, which is basically sort of a series of public ed, public awareness pieces that are My Strength Is Not For Hurting, and then it's sort of a series of So When She Said No, I Said Okay. You know, redefining this notion of masculinity and what it means to be a strong man doesn't have to involve sexual violence or violence for any measure. And I think one of the things I love about Men Can Stop Rape is the thing that I think they're really good about sharing is that a lot of these norms of masculinity that often involve sort of sexual aggression or toughness toward women aren't real good for men either. There's a lot of boys that don't like them either. There's a lot of boys that don't fit this, you know, what a strong man should be, and they don't like it either. And so, you know, you can really engage a lot of men, again, as your allies. My organization, so I'll put in a plug, I love what my colleagues have done. So it's our Coaching Boys Into Men campaign. And this really is about, again, how do you take male leaders, coaches, parents, fathers, and ask them to sort of step out of their comfort zone a little bit and use their influence on other younger men and boys to say violence against women is always wrong and it's not okay. And the important next piece, here's what a healthy relationship looks like. You know, and again, I think we're real good at telling young people what not to do. We're not always good at telling them how to do it and how to do awkward things. You know, negotiating relationships is difficult and challenging for anyone, particularly young people, and particularly negotiating young sexual relationships among adolescents. And I think for anybody they can be tough, but I think for kids we have a much harder time teaching them how to address that. And again, here I wanted to just include in the slide some of the resources for you. The National Alliance to End Sexual Violence is the Association of State Domestic Violence Coalitions. RAIN runs the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Those are the top and bottom. A lot of the study you saw, a lot of the data you saw came from the National, again, Violence Against Women Survey, which is out there, and you can pull up a lot of the data on the DOJ site. And then the CDC, of course, is where we go for, you know, most of our best basic data. And then do we have time or how? Okay. So then I did want to jump a little bit to something that happened last week that I'm very excited about, and I thought this audience would be very excited to learn about. And this is a new piece of legislation called the International Violence Against Women Act. And this is about the United States government stepping up and committing in our diplomatic relations and with our resources and in the aid that we already give to do a much better job of addressing gender-based violence and violence against women and its relationship to all of our other goals. So again, whether it's HIV/AIDS, whether it's peace and security, whether it's the work we do around, in crisis or conflict settings, that we need to address gender-based violence, A, because it's a human rights issue that we need to engage in, and B, it's an impediment to all of these other things that we are investing resources in and care about as people. So over 5 years, it authorizes $1 billion, which is a pretty strong commitment in this climate in particular. The legislation right now is trying to identify 10 to 20 focus countries. But again, the The idea for that is that it would be the holistic approach, right? So it's this thing that we keep talking about is that we can't have just one great clinic over here and one great men's program over here and one great public health program, you know, public ed or awareness program over here. It's let's, instead of spreading out across the world as much as the need is there, let's try to focus on 10 to 20 countries and let's try to do all the pieces in that country and see if we can do it. See if we can really start documenting some change. So it is very much about how do we integrate screening and assessment for violence into existing healthcare delivery systems. And in some places, that's going to be the VCT clinic. In some places, it's going to be a family planning clinic. You know, where are people getting healthcare, and how do we get violence into that better? And how do we then understand the implications of violence for those services that we're already providing? More on research and data collections, particularly operations research. That was the thing we were most focused on, which is what are good programs? And how do we scale them up and expand them and still keep them culturally relevant, right? So that's always going to be the balance, which is how do we not reinvent the wheel every time, but then how do we still understand everything is going to be culturally specific. And then there's also a real focus on sexual violence and conflict, I think specifically driving from what's been going on in the DRC and Darfur, which have been getting so much attention here in the U.S., that would actually require the U.S. government to have a response. which is that we can't just sit and watch it happen and read the stories in the newspaper, but that the U.S. government, when we identify, I think the language is mass outbreaks of sexual violence, that we now have an obligation to respond and react. And I'm happy to offer more questions about that as well. I think that's it. And there's my information, and thank you so much. Okay, sure. Sure. I think I had said in my presentation that the U.S. is not, I think, as advanced as we often think we are in this issue relative to other places in the world. And the question was then, was there a specific place I had in mind, and I think sort of how and why. And I think, to be honest, I did not have a specific place in mind. I just know that often the U.S. likes to talk about, you know, we're going to go teach the world how to do things in a lot of our foreign policy and in a lot of our services. And so I was just sort of responding to the fact that I think we have a lot to learn from other countries and other practitioners. And so there was no specific place I had in mind when I said that. And that I think people in this country do think that we're far ahead when it comes to the rights of women and when it comes to opinions about sexual violence and sexual assault. Again, if you do a public opinion survey about what Americans think, you would think that there is zero tolerance. You would think that we live in a place where there is no sexual violence. If you look at a public opinion survey, when you look at sort of the reality of the experience, that's just not at all the case. Yeah. Well, yes, and there's a lot of work around that. And so in the Violence Against Women Act, this was sort of the very interesting thing, is that we were able to actually get in some really good language around immigration, even from some of our harshest anti-immigrant members of Congress. So women who are victims of violence have access to a U visa. So if you are an undocumented victim of violence, you may get a visa to stay in the country. And so that is one of the critical pieces that was in the Violence Against Women Act. We also have a T visa, which is a trafficking visa, which is, again, if you were brought into the country, obviously against your will, you are going to be undocumented. And this would, again, give you the rights and status to stay. We're trying to get whether these visas are tied to benefits and how long you can stay and whether you have to participate in prosecution, which is obviously very touchy. Who has the power to grant at this point, who gets to decide whether you really are a victim is often the person who really wants you to help them prosecute their case. And so if you don't want to prosecute your case, and particularly if there's someone in your own country who knows your family, who you owe money to, or your family owes money to, there's a good chance you have no interest whatsoever in participating necessarily in prosecution. So we're still working on those things, but yes, in the Violence Against Women Act, there's a lot. There's an organization called Legal Momentum, and there's a network that my organization also co-chairs with Legal Momentum that is the national network to end violence against immigrant women. And I also think the immigrant women community is much better at sort of understanding the domestic and sexual violence needs, and also looking at the intersections of how immigration status makes you even more vulnerable to Okay, I'm going to repeat the question. I'm going to try to shorten it, so correct me if I don't capture it correctly. But really the question is, what's the chicken and the egg between, if you know you don't really have services, is it really fair or ethical to ask the question? But if you don't ask the question, you're never going to have services or the right services, because you're just not going to necessarily see it as a problem as well. And so my organization, I'll be honest, we take a position about, we've really moved from screening to the issue of assessment. We do believe you ask. About that it's a part of care that you do ask the question. We do it for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is we feel like there's arguments either way, and what we say is that you need to couple that assessment with lots of training, and that they have to go hand in hand. That healthcare providers understand, and that it's health systems, right? It's not just a few docs or a few nurses or a few community health workers. It really is trying to get the system trained, you know, even in sort of situations where there's fewer resources. It's a question, and our argument is you're not going to provide the care if you don't know that. So it really is, from our perspective, it's a medical issue about you're not going to provide them the care that they need if you don't ask the question and you don't know the answer. So it's in your best interest, I think it's exactly what was said earlier, it's in your best interest to know the truth, because then you can decide what's going to be the best treatment for them. So from our perspective, that's one issue. I think the other thing that we've looked at, and again, I'm a little bit more familiar with it, particularly around domestic violence, but often they're not that separate, again, in people's lives, is we found, again, particularly a colleague who was doing work with rape survivors, rape survivors in Kosovo, which is that you often had people who had never talked about it, right? And so what they saw is that even in places where there was nothing that they could necessarily offer, and these people were pained deeply about how do you ask, have somebody tell you these stories about their lives, and say, okay, thanks, you know, and walk out the door. And the thing that they really found was the ability to talk about it for the first time, the ability for someone to say, I am so sorry that happened to you, that was wrong. You shouldn't have had to go through that. And just that act in and of itself is an intervention, and a very valuable one. And they actually found some relationship, and again, I don't have this data handy, but this is what was told by a colleague, to that and suicidality. There's the point at which someone at least has the chance to talk about it, has the chance to acknowledge it, to say what happened to them, and for somebody to say that's wrong and I'm sorry, that can still in and of itself have an impact. And so that's, again, those sort of two perspectives are what inform our decision that, yes, we think you should ask, but you need to do it with these other things in place. Okay, great.
Thank you.
Okay, sure.